laughter and apocalypse.
You are listening to Nakedly Examined Music, a podcast about songs and songwriting. My name is Mark Lintonmeyer. For more information on this podcast, please see nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. My guest for episode 19 is Chad Clark, who since 2001 has been the leader of the band Beauty Pill. However, right now you're hearing A Good Day by his previous band Smart Went Crazy from their second 1997 album Con Art. Chad's current music is much more electronics-based, with a very rich sound tapestry. We're going to focus our attention primarily on their current album. Beauty Pill describes things as they are, which came out in 2015, covering first Africana Barista and then Stephen and Tuwonge. This album has gained a lot of critical acclaim. Chad has talked about the latter song on NPR. For our third song, we're going to go back to their first EP, Cigarette Girl from the Future. The song is The Idiot Heart. And finally, we're going to hear another song from the current album, this one a cover called The Prize, originally by Arto Lindsay. For more information on the band, check out beautypill.com. Let's get into it. So as the introduction, I had suggested playing the thing that Spotify says was Smart Went Crazy's most popular song, A Good Day from Con Art. It seemed to have a nice little, I like the intro.
It's interesting that that would be the most popular song. That was actually the song that was dropped from, it was dropped from the vinyl version of the record. Ian MacKay did not want to make a double record. And so we dropped like five pieces from it. And that was one of them. The other ones were shorter, kind of experimental pieces. But that was one of the songs that got dropped. So it's interesting that it's like it's ended up being one of the more popular songs.
I guess so. You never know. Well, I guess it's not like people are thinking back to what's that thing that I remember Chad from the radio from, at least unless it's this year, unless it's.
Yeah, it's a weird thing. The way that people generally find the music that I've made has often been because of like critical response as opposed to any kind of radio or any other source.
Well, let's edge toward the first song. So it's Africana Barista. So this is from the current record. Beauty Pill Describes Things as They Are, came out in 2015. I just got through listening to you on the Chunky Glasses podcast.
Oh, yes.
And I will refer folks to that so that you don't feel like you have to repeat those stories. If they want to hear more about how this record was made, about the crazy amount of time since your last release before this record and what was happening during that time and the buildup, like it's all a great story. But let's try to focus more or less on the music. So we're going to play the whole song in full here in a second. What, do you have any introductory words about sort of what it's about, how the listener should approach it?
This song was written as a kind of a shadow or a photo negative song of David Bowie and Iggy Pop's China Girl.
Ah.
It kind of features the same cultural dynamic, but reversed. If you think about their song and you think about this song.
I'm trying to remember any of the verses of that song. It's just, ooh, my little China girl. That's what I remember from that song.
It's a very dark song. It's kind of sexy in a way, but also sinister. It suggests a kind of predatory relationship between the singer and the object of the song, the woman that he's singing to. There's a kind of condescension and fetishizing that happens in that song. And it gets really, really terrifying at the end when he goes into a rant about visions of swastikas and stuff.
Okay, so that's the tip off that it's not merely a misogynistic rock song, that it's actually self-aware commentary on this relationship.
I think of it as an enlightened piece of music. I mean, race and culture are interesting to me. I'm a black man in the world of indie rock, and there are a number of aspects of this song. Musically, it's extremely repetitive. It's based on basically one motif that stays static for a very long time as the music shifts around it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, there are a number of aspects of the song that I thought were worth discussing.
Well, let's do that, but let's play it for him first then.
Thank you.
again, here again, here again. Here again, here again, here again, here again. With the rush of revenants who need to get amphetamized. Some mistake you for Australian. We'll be right back.
You were talking about the repetitive riff. I was trying to figure out what mood is this song exactly. I almost feel like, is groove a mood? I mean, it's got that kind of jazzy thing, especially with the horns that you have that
yes.
really play off of the...
it swings a little.
Of the nice percussion. Yes, yes. That play well with the aggressive percussion. One of the descriptions I'd read of your music was cinematic, but I don't see that because cinematic says to me almost either there's an identifiable traditional mood, like it's telling you how to feel,
right?
Which this is not doing. I feel like it's more musically self-involved.
I heard the motif as being like when it first entered my head, I felt like it had a kind of lumbering darkness to it. I thought there was somewhat of a like stomping elephant kind of, I don't know. My brain is weird, but one of the aspects of the song is that it was originally supposed to feel more like go-go music, DC's go-go music. Are you familiar with that music at all?
Not really.
Go-go music is a indigenous black DC music that has this amazing triplet swing to it and is very organically generated. There's almost a tribal aspect. It's often layered with lots of percussion. It's very funky, it's very festive, and very positive, and it has this kind of swing to it. Africana Barista doesn't, I should be clear, does not sound like go-go music exactly. But I had wanted to do something that had a little bit of a go-go influence, and so this swing aspect comes from go-go.
Is go-go typically that slow, or is it more, I mean, when you say funky, that usually means at least 120 beats per minute, not the slow groove?
Go-go is faster and definitely more fun than our music.
Uh-huh.
You're right. Go-go is faster for sure. And it's bouncier and it's more social and inclusive than Africana Barista, but it's still a little bit, I hear a relationship between the two musics. And it was inspired by a real thing that happened in the song. It's exploded and dramatized, but I did develop a kind of flirtatious exchange with this woman that worked at a coffee shop. And, you know, it took me a while to figure out where she was from. And then there was a kind of a spark between us. It was very faint. And then once I figured out where she was from, I thought about all of the things that a white woman, particularly from her nation, all the ideas she might have about a black man. And it's very complicated. Race is a very complicated topic, and that's why I think it's endlessly interesting to explore in songs. The China girl dynamic of, you know, you're from a dominant culture and I'm not, and this country, America, leaving South Africa aside, has the Tuskegee experiments and lots of really atrocious, horrible, heinous incidents of racial violence and discrimination. But I was thinking, like, what does a white woman from South Africa, what goes through your brain? How many images have you absorbed of what you think, you know, what you imagine that I am? And I should be very clear, like, in reality, we did not actually develop a relationship. I'm an artist, and I was sparked to explore the idea of it and made an entire story out of it. But in actuality, I mean, that's really what songwriting is, at least for me. Is taking a small feeling and magnifying it and exploding it and exploring it. You say that the song has a neutral quality or a mysterious quality in the music in terms of the emotional tone.
I was trying to figure that out. I mean, whenever you introduce sounds that are strange and exotic, I mean, the whole beginning of the song, you've got the spinning bowl that then turns into this electronica thing that introduces the riff slowly so that if you know what's coming, then you can hear that that's, oh, okay, you're playing some of the notes from the da 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 da. But like hearing it the first time, it's just weird noises. It's tuned percussion, but tuned percussion with pitch shifting involved. So it has to be electronic. It's not no, unless, you know, a talking drum maybe, or there are probably some things that the Bode saw or something that could approximate that kind of noise. And then you come on with the big riff thing. And even within the verse, it's kind of got a, yeah, we're standing in line at a coffee shop, but yet on the third line, with the rush of reverends who need to get amphetamized, you even have a more aggressive, loud drum thing that kind of comes in and is really aggressively jazzy on top of things. That so it's a, I'm not saying it's neutral, but I'm not sure what it is.
That's very interesting to hear you describe it that way. The primary reason I thought it was an interesting song to discuss, is I thought that the song was headed to a dark place. When I was writing the song, and it took me a long time to write it, I designed it and wrote it fairly quickly, most of it. But then at the very end, I kept thinking it has to have a very dark, savage ending, similar to the ending of China Girl. Like, it has to go to a very dark and sad place, a hopeless place, or something. Like, I was convinced that it was headed to a tragic kind of outcome. I was so convinced that I tried to write several endings that just ended up being fucking corny and never felt right, never felt authentic, never felt natural. So I heard this song as having a sinister quality. That's why all of the sounds have a slightly kind of electric or threatening kind of character. But I thought it was going to end very darkly. What really surprised me is that at a certain point, I felt like the song was telling me, no, you got it wrong. And there's no reason why this song has to end darkly. It's the 21st century. It's not that weird for two people from different cultures and with different races to get together. There's nothing that charged about that at this point. And there's no reason why, even if her culture has a oppressive history and my culture has an oppressive history, there's no reason why it couldn't work out between those two characters. Basically, the song was like, why are you making a big deal about this? And at the very end of the song, the words came to me the way the song ends. Origins, not destination.
You got to move on somehow.
Got to move on somehow. And that's like, I didn't expect that to be the way the song would go. It really surprised me. And I found myself, I mean, again, like a lot of this is like happening in my head and in my imagination. But the day that I wrote that, I kind of found myself in tears because I was like, there's no reason why this has to be, why this can't be a rainbow, kind of a bright feeling at the end. It's heavier in a way if it suddenly turns bright or if there's hope. It's not interesting to make a song about racial tension or the inference of racial tension that simply goes to a dark place. It's not a particularly provocative or interesting idea. It was much more interesting that it ends with some hope. And that is, to me, why I wanted to talk about the song, because to me, the song is ultimately just a love song. It ends with just singing, I want to be the one you like, which is really like old fashioned, like Beatles, early Beatles sentiment, you know, like a very like, I want to hold your hand, like very raw, rudimentary, romantic idea. And that's, to me, what's cool about the song.
Yeah. So when you came up with that last line, did you come up with the line before it, the bloody, bloody subjugation, the history between us now? Was that at the same, you know, the couplet came together? Because that's really the first time that you're overtly bringing up that there's racial tension or something. There's,
yes.
If somebody just saw that, especially if they didn't know you were black or didn't, you know, didn't have any of that subtext, then it would just be, it's some comment about Africa, and there's an African flavor to the music a little bit. It's not blatant like China Girl.
Yeah, I don't know. I only really, to me, the title has enough charge to it that I feel like all of those things are implied. But maybe that's just my perspective.
I think it's just incredibly economical songwriting. I mean, you're saying you're dramatizing this out, but really, we're talking about the whole thing is
two verses. Could fit on.
It's three, according to here, but yeah.
But yeah, no, I hear you.
Outside of a napkin.
That's another really interesting thing. I was listening to your Craig Wedren interview. He's so interesting. And I was just so taken by the way that he thinks. I have actually worked on a Craig solo record. One of the most interesting things about songwriting to me is the economizing that you're forced to do. I mean, as you can hear, as you're talking to me now, I'm a pretty long-winded guy. Like, I use a lot of words. You know, I'm often circuitous. I overtalk things sometimes. And, like, songs require you and poems require you to distill. And there's a whole film in my head of what happens in Africana Barista, but it can only be alluded to in a kind of minimal sort of way with the number of syllables that you have, you know, available to you in the narrative. So, yeah, I don't know whether people get all this stuff at all.
Well, it's interesting what sort of the way that you choose to then elaborate, because overall your songs are not particularly short. But the way that the reason, you know, at the end of this song, there's after the third verse has happened. So after kind of the story is out of the way, then you've got the horns come in the most prominent way they've been. I guess they were playing the riff along with everything else before, but they were kind of understated. You wouldn't necessarily even hear that they were real horns. That didn't stick out to me. But then you've got them 3 minutes and 30 seconds into the song, and the song is what, about 6 minutes. Like that's when the lyrics are done, except for this just repeated thing. So you're letting the musical motifs pretty gradually develop themselves out, that you've got this long growing horn riff. I just watched the official video of the song, and it's sort of where the most kaleidoscopic colors start swirling around. that.
Thanks for bringing that up. That all that exposition, I mean, there's many layers of the song. One of the things that's also happening is I love Henry Threadgill. Do you know Henry Threadgill?
No.
He's a jazz composer who does this amazing big band music, but not in any kind of, not big band in any kind of Duke Ellington sort of way, but a much more avant-garde, futuristic leaning. He's been working for about 30 years now. I think he's in his 70s. He was an original member of the Art Ensemble of Chicago. The horns in my mind were kind of an homage to his sensibility. Some people hear Coltrane in it, or Ornette Coleman, or Fela, and those are all things that I like and I say thumbs up to. But in my mind, I was thinking of Henry Threadgill.
Yeah, there's not enough shrieking for Ornette Coleman. There's not, the horns are too.
There are a lot of sweet moments in Ornette Coleman. He has this reputation for being so difficult, but it's not that bad. But no, I know what you mean. Yeah, the song is long. I sometimes tell people the song is 7 minutes long. And they're like, no, you know, and I'm like, yeah, it's 7 minutes long and it's the same riff for 7 minutes. You should hate that. That's something you should hate. That's a violation of all rules of entertainment. But you're right. There's not a lot of words in the song and there's a lot of time.
Just the voyage from. So after that initial horn riff, I mean, it fades out into strings, so we have a little string part and then, you know, the riff continues, but it becomes strictly just the horns and bass, I believe. Everything else drops out. So you're making this voyage from the beginning where it was just electronica and it was even kind of fragmented electronica. You weren't even hearing the whole riff. And then through the verses where the drums get very aggressive. And now, you know, it's not really until the, I guess after the first chorus where you have got the first ba-da, ba-da, like, identifiable kind of big band horn part thing. And then that's taken over by the end of the song. So it's kind of like the pleasant aspect of the song has taken over. So I think that ambiguous mood, that a groove by itself is enough to be interesting, but it's not enough to sort of establish a, you're supposed to be happy now, or you're supposed to be sad now. It's the other stuff that has to connote that. And the fact that you have, I think that it's ambiguous in that way, that it's so groove oriented, gives you the ability to then make that voyage from this electronic beginning to the very acoustic horn part at the end.
I really appreciate your detailed analysis. It's very interesting to me. There's a point that one thing I'd like to point out, which is that there's a moment where the strings sort of take over towards the end, mm-hmm. where the music suddenly becomes kind of turns major key, or like the tone shifts. And everything becomes brighter and sweeter. And that, I have to give credit to my bandmate, Jean. She was the person who first identified that that was an unusual enough, you know, compositional thing that it should be reinforced with strings. My bandmate, Jean, is a violinist. When I asked her to join the band, I had no intention of having her play violin. I wanted her to sing and do other things. But violin is her main instrument, and she's a virtuoso. It was her idea to underscore and reinforce that as strongly as we could with the swell of strings. And I feel like that's where the music suddenly feels like, hey, everything might work out all right. And then the last line, which some people, because of the nature of my voice, people hear as ironic. People think that the I want to be the one you like is an ironic thing or like a sarcastic thing. But I really mean it very genuinely. Like my intent, it was not in any way any kind of a sardonic thing. I really wanted to express desire and affection in a pretty straightforward way. That was my intent, at least.
That's how it came off to me. What's unique about it, I mean, you're saying it's a love song, but it's a love song that's not over dramatic. even love songs in which it's just the scene is somebody flirting with a bartender or something might be, my heart is singing and out of control where, you know, I can't say all this to you, but I'm sort of using the music to express the craziness.
Right.
But that's not what's going on in this song. Unless you're going to interpret the thematic is once you get past the gotta moves on somehow, that the horn explosion is the consequent date and sexual fulfillment. But I didn't read it like that.
Yeah, I'm not sure I was going that literal.
Hopefully that would not be ending with 18 times saying, I want to be the one you like in a possibly sardonic sounding manner. That would not be the best post-coital gesture.
I have to say, it's a bummer thing about my singing voice, which is different from my speaking voice. People always hear what I'm singing as being acerbic or sarcastic or snarky or and always kind of sinister. And it's actually bummed me out. Like, as a singer, I would like to have access to, as a communicator, to the full range of human emotion. I mean, wouldn't I feel like any artist would want that? And, you know, like there's a Beauty Pill song, which is called You, Yes, You.
Mm-hmm.
It's a short, really, really, really sweet love song. And the opening line is, this song was written many, many years ago when Michael Jackson was alive. The opening line of the song is, you remind me of the Jackson 5 back when Michael Jackson was still alive. And at the time, you know, that was referring to what a weird zombie he'd become. And, you know, of course, since he died, it now seems kind of a strange, I'm not sure people get it. I didn't anticipate his death. But everyone hears that line. People hear that song as being very darkly sinister. And I was really trying to write a very sweet love song, like about falling in love with a woman. And it's a popular song in our set, but sometimes I feel like it's for the wrong reason. People, I recognize when making a reference to Michael Jackson in that way at that time, there was a little bit of a joke aspect to it.
Hey, I've got a song from the 90s that references Cosby. So I feel for you. Things change in retrospect.
Yeah. It's something that I struggle with, people thinking that I'm being more acerbic than I intend to be.
So this brings to mind, since you brought up Gene, I want to talk more about how this works as a band versus you sitting at your computer. Like the whole beginning of Africana Barista sounds like, you know, maybe not the bowl itself, but once the synths and the drum machines come in, that's you in your producer god mode using cool software, correct? Or at least that's how you demo it all. And then you decide when you bring it to the band, what's going to be replaced, how real drums are going to be overlapped, that kind of stuff. Is that what happened with this?
Yeah, I mean, not as much software as you might imagine, but yes, that's a fair description.
Tell me a little specifically
describe as producer god.
Well, you've produced a lot of great albums, which we should just throw that out there. We don't have to talk about that aspect of things, but and I imagine that's where you got a lot of your arrangement chops together in terms of writing string or horn parts or synth parts that approximate those things.
It's a good question. I think it might be the other way around, but I don't know.
Okay.
You know, in the sense that, like, I think the reason why I gravitated to this line of work is that I naturally have a sense of arrangement, and arrangement is kind of everything.
Now, back with Smart Went Crazy, was that a more traditional band setup where you were playing guitar and singing and everybody came up with their own part, or were you getting deep into the arrangements with that as well back at that point?
The song that you've selected, A Good Day, was written by the entire band, like as a band.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of Smart Went Crazy songs were me coming in with kind of a song completed and basically saying to people, here, play this. But arguably, Smart Went Crazy's best song was written entirely as a band.
And then that band breaks up. 2001, you put together Beauty Pill, which is just you and the guy who was the bass player from Smart Went Crazy, but was playing drums for you, right? And then and a female singer. So the idea of having somebody else sing, and I read somewhere else that you even had in mind that, you know, my voice is not that great. I'm going to have, the woman's going to sing just about everything. And, you know, that's going to be the identity of the band. And that's not the way it turned out.
It's not. It's a bummer.
But it's been a consistent thing, even though you've gone through, what, 4 different women being the in that place in the band?
Is it 4?
But it's at least 3.
Rachel and Gino, 3.
Okay.
Yes.
And being like the band that has a woman in it, like I'm surprised, say on this song, that on Here Again, Here Again, Here Again, you know, if you were talking Heads, at least in their later era, you would have the Tina Weymouth voice harmonizing you or something and making that kind of part of the sound. But it seems that, and the third song we're going to talk about, in fact, is one where you had the female singer do the whole thing. And even in the first verse where it's really low, where it sounds like that could have been something that you would sing and then Joanne would take over, she's just singing the whole thing. Was that sort of an intentional, any given song is going to have, this is the singer, that you're not the mamas and the papas. You're not doing harmonies, at least in the studio.
The original idea of Beauty Pill was that I had been the lead singer of a band. I'd been the lead singer in Smart and Crazy. I didn't feel suited to being the front man. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
I mean, I think it's one of the reasons why I have gravitated to being a producer. Like, I enjoy very much being in the background and playing a little bit of the wizard behind the curtain kind of role. And so I don't think I've ever grown up with any kind of strong desire for attention. And a lot of the great lead singers I've found are people who had to fight to get people's attention and were very, very good at that. And I never really felt totally suited to it. So anyway, with Beauty Pill, my intention was to sing some of the songs, but over time to slowly have my voice decrease its presence in the music. That was the original plan. My ultimate goal was, like, I wasn't going to be the singer at all. I would just write songs and work on the sounds and be kind of like a little bit of a Massive Attack kind of project. That was my original idea. That didn't work. And particularly on this record, I am definitely the lead singer of this album. That's sort of just what the songs wanted. And all of our attempts to try to undo that or try to, you know, take things in a different direction just didn't work.
Let's maybe get our second song on the table. So this is also from the current album, and we can talk more about the way that you recorded that and your interaction with the bandmates and blah, blah, blah. But so this is Stephen and Tuonge, which I heard you did an NPR telling the story of this. Pretty awesome. Do you want to just give us the short version here?
Well, yeah, this is a song that explores the duality of the way couples look at the world and the contrast of perspectives. You know, often in a couple, there's one person who is kind of more of a risk taker, bolder, I suppose one might say. And then there's a person who is the person who is the more sensible, kind of conservative person in the couple. I thought that was an interesting topic, how that dynamic exists in most couples that I know. So this song, the setting of this song is a gay couple in Malawi, or actually one member who is trans. They're real people. They're a real story that actually happened about 5 years ago.
And are still in prison? Is that the...
happened to them is not completely clear to me.
Okay. Well, not relevant to the song, but we can link folks to the story.
I've done some research I've tried to follow their story since it's a little bit out of focus exactly what has happened. But it seems like the dynamic that is suggested by the song did exist in real life. So I feel like there's a genuine truth in the song. But they were persecuted and prosecuted by the Malawian government, basically for having a not straight relationship. And they were imprisoned for that. And there was a global outrage directed at the government, and eventually the government acquiesced to the outrage and let them go.
Okay.
But anyway, so this song is set in an imaginary, like it's a play in a way. It's a scene. They're in a hotel room, or they're in some kind of room that's on maybe a second floor of a building, maybe an apartment or something. And they're in bed and they hear the police coming to apprehend them. And they have to figure out within a minute what they're going to do. And one of the, I'm going to arbitrarily say this is Stephen. Stephen decides that this is the moment where they clearly have to give up. They clearly need to let it go. The government is onto them. It's over. And he thinks that they should jump out the window and run in separate directions and never see each other again. that is what he thinks is the smart choice. And Tuange has a very opposite reaction, a very opposite idea, which is she agrees that they should jump out the window, but she thinks they should run off together and that this is that they need to continue to defy the unjust government that is persecuting them. It's a very sad situation. It's a very sad story. It's something that I took very seriously because I knew it was based on the real lives of real people, people I had never met or interviewed, but I didn't take it lightly. But I primarily wanted to explore a universal, what I think is an interesting universal topic, which is that couples think differently.
All right, well, let's play the song and folks know to listen carefully then to verse one in the first chorus, which is from one perspective, and verse two in the second chorus, which is from the other one.
Bye.
So this is another one, groove oriented. It's got an electronic bed here, a pretty damn cool rhythm bed where, you know, it still sounds like it has a steady. I mean, when I see the clips of you guys playing live, you know, the drummer is keeping a pretty steady backbeat, but then you've got all this stuff on the, it sounds like on one side, maybe on the left side, there's a kind of a trippy electronic thing. And then on the right side, it's maybe more elaborations on an actual kit. It wasn't really clear, but in any case, a nice cool bed, you know, that of course then comes in after this. Where did this initial, I'm reading into the story that you've told that it sounds like you've got kind of you've got two things that are not quite in sync. And you're kind of hearing them, you know, over time as they get in sync and out of sync and back in.
I never expected anyone to pick up on that. It's really exciting to me when people notice that there's two things that are not in sync, because I feel like that's the poetry of the song. But I never expected anyone to pick up on that. I feel like it's a pretty subtle thing. So if anyone notices that, you're instantly my friend.
It's only after hearing you tell the story that I'm connecting that. But I was thinking about how are you actually making this sound? And it just sounded like, you know, that they're slightly out of sync, but in a mathematically precise way, so that none of them actually sounds like they're simply off the beat. It's that they're staggering sort of within the beat.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a huge fan of Steve Reich.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Reich. I always called him Steve Reich, but someone told me that his name is Steve Reich. I don't know. But yeah, the exploration of phase in music is interesting to me. There is a symbolism in the initial kind of Morse code beeping sounds that happened that opened the song. How there's one that has a Doppler effect on it and the other one does not. Mm. And so they go in and out of, and they create polyrhythms simply by not being synchronized. And the analogy of a couple being at odds with each other is pretty apparent. At least I hope it is.
Well, I hadn't thought of it as Morse code, but now that you're saying that, of course, the pitch of it. And then you have some remnant of that that lasts throughout the song, right?
Yes. You hear it at the end as almost there's an alarm kind of quality to it. I mean, to me, all of this is, as someone inside of the music, I find all of these sounds to have emotional charge. I'm never interested in just like making cool sounds. Like, I don't think that that's any good way to make a record. People sometimes try to hire me or want to hire me because they associate me with like, you're the guy who makes the cool sounds. And to me, there's always a kind of a poetic origin to any of these things. They come out of what the new music or what the narrative is asking for. So, yeah, so there you have it.
Well, in this one, the tone of the song is defined by that initial guitar riff, which sounds very wistful to me. I mean, I was trying to figure out what it was. And it's basically, you know, just G minor to like a D over F sharp, if you were playing it as chords, but you don't play it as chords. There's no backing instrument, at least in any of the parts that were obvious to me, that are just playing the whole chord. It's always playing little bits of the chord so that it's the melody that has the emphasis.
Yeah. You know, I have very little formal musical knowledge, so I rarely ever know what that we're doing a G chord or anything like that, which can be frustrating for my bandmate.
As a guitarist, that's really interesting. Okay. I guess I noticed when I was seeing you playing live that you were mostly doing riffs and not chords.
I don't even know how to make chords. Honestly, I mean, that's the part of punk that was interesting to me, was that anyone could do it and just, you know, like you don't have to be an expert in order to just get up and try to express yourself. Beauty Pill tends to draw a reaction that's pretty fascinated with the details and the production and the expectation of sophistication in what we're doing, but I'm still aware of the punk origin of what I'm doing.
Well, that's interesting, coupling that with, you know, your obvious expertise and emphasis on the sonic landscape, on just how, you know, that thing I was describing about this drum bed at the beginning, like I could easily see how that could just sound like a bunch of cluttered nonsense. But despite the complexity and the, tell me, so is that, was I right? Is it electronic drums on the left and real drums on the right with, over a steady beat that's going in the middle?
Oh, yes, that's okay. True.
And the real drums are kind of doing some pretty flashy little jazz riffs, you know, that sound pretty off the cuff, that just add flavor from moment to moment.
Yes, Devin is a really expressive, creative drummer, and Beauty Pill's music is welcoming of that kind of approach. Especially lately, we're not requiring the drums to, I mean, I'm very hip hop influenced. My favorite music is De La Soul and Tribe Called Quest. And the sonic exploration in Beauty Pills music comes from that influence. So there's an NPC at the core of a lot of what we're doing. So Devin is not required necessarily in a lot of situations to be the person who holds the beat down in the traditional sense of that's what the drummer does, is to keep the pulse going. The pulse in our situation can come from a NPC or some other source. So Devin is able to play more freely and more floridly and decoratively. When we play live, he is definitely the drummer that plays a lot. But in rock music, that can be really a bummer.
Yes.
And the drummer who overplays is the worst. But in the case of Beauty Pill, it's really encouraging. The music actually is asking that of him, to be decorative and to be as colorful as possible.
Sure. I've long looked for, like, can I get a two drummer band where one guy does the funky percussion stuff and fills up that extra space? But it's hard to find somebody who's satisfied with that role, at least with my music.
Yeah, I mean, I feel really fortunate that the music that I make seems to be so suited to the people that I've found.
And just while we're talking about the arrangement, so it seems like certainly on this, you've got an actual bass riff holding things down. I wasn't completely sure on the Africana Barista whether it was synth bass. Is that sort of an essential part of the sound, to have that human element of an actual bass, or do you just...
Yes.
You know, okay.
I think so, yeah.
And then again, since you didn't answer the question the first time, you've got a good female singer in the band. Why are you singing all the harmonies yourself? It's just because it's easier and you can have the certain transparency of having your own voice layered on the choruses here?
Well, a lot of times the vocals on this album were just from the original demo.
Gotcha.
And transposed. And that is the case for this song, for sure. But she sings on that song as well.
Oh, okay.
Maybe not as apparent in the mix, but yeah.
Yeah. And then, you know, one of the things that you introduce here, well, you again have this, I guess it was on the first song where the way that when you repeat something again and again at the end, one of the things that makes it worth going on that long is that you introduce more echo effect. I was trying to remember if you did that on the slide, the bureau against the door. Oh yeah. No, it's, I love you. I say, let's go. So that's the part where you have the echo stuff getting introduced, where you're, using backing vocals against yourself with a delay pedal or just manual echoing.
A lot of these songs seem to want to go into codas that basically cycled and faded out. That was not typical of, and I don't think Beauty Pill had ever done that before this album. I don't think I've ever written songs that, I might be wrong, I might be misremembered, but I don't think I've ever written songs that faded out before. All my songs have ended with a particular note or something like that. But these songs all seem to want to keep cycling. I really love New Order's Blue Monday.
Hmm.
What I consider to be like the genius simplicity, I guess, of that song. And that's something that I would like to continue to move towards. As I keep going, I would like to get increasingly more elegant and economical. That would be my hope. I can't promise that will actually happen, but that's what I would like.
I hear that in a lot of the arrangement. I mean, despite my comment about some of the splashy drum stuff, for the most part, it's very, now a lead guitar part comes in that's just two notes going back and forth with a nice delay pedal on it, so that you can kind of make sense of the little pieces that are coming in. And yeah, I definitely, it's like adding dabs of a primary color to your painting, as opposed to some delicately shaded thing that is more realistic.
As I said, I'm a devotee of Tribe Called Quest, and that is a band that pretty much stayed for almost all of their songs within probably a 5 or 6 beat per minute range.
So that it was all at the maximum level of groove, all at 120 or something like that?
I don't even know what it is, but it's like you can tell that all their songs have a similar kind of lope. And they explored that and became the masters of that. And that's really interesting and cool to me. I was trying to like remove bridges. In Smart and Crazy, my old band, almost all of the songs have a bridge.
Right. The Idiot Heart that we'll get to in a second, at least, well, it's an instrumental bridge, but at least it's something that you're playing a different chord for a while. And there's none of that in these. They sort of keep to the mood that they're trying to set from the beginning.
Yes, that was cool to me. I mean, I love dance music and I love Steve Reich and I love hip hop and all of these things have the hypnotic, like a spell casting simplicity that is very, very elegant and very cool to me. And I would like to keep going in that direction.
What I like about the repetition that's in your songs is that if you listen closely to the arrangement, there's always something going on. It's never merely repetition. It's always something dynamic, or you're doing something with the instrumental bed. So I like that. I guess the one thing that kind of threw me, because I feel like I'm kind of an impatient person, that if I have something that repeats again and again, then maybe it repeats and it gets more crazy. And like, I associate repetition with insanity, not with relaxation, not with so getting past that was necessary for me to appreciate.
Do you like dance music? Do you listen to dance music?
I don't listen to a lot of dance music.
Okay.
So that's probably part of where that comes from. Yes, I'm the guy I would get together with people like, let's just jam. And of course, if you're just going jamming with people, then usually it's not a matter of, unless they're, hey, everybody, can you follow my hands as I move them around? Like, no, it's something that's going to stay on the same chord, whether it's a blues jam or whatever. And that's the kind of thing that I would get bored with, like too fast.
Yes.
Easily.
That certainly is a peril. If you make something that has no life and is dull, repeating it is going to be bad.
Sure, yes.
But if it casts a spell, I think that that's exciting. When I tell non-musicians that, Africana Barista is one motif for 7 minutes, and essentially that should drive you fucking crazy. And they're like, oh, I never noticed that. That's exciting to me. Prince died a month ago. It just killed me. And I was remarking on Twitter about how When Doves Cry and the song Kiss, neither of those songs have bass lines. And they're both huge hits. There's no bass on either of those songs.
There's nothing in the bass range? It's not just
nothing,
a synth bass? There's
no,
okay.
Nothing at all. And it's not the kind of thing you would notice because the spell of the song is so great. And they're just huge hit songs missing an instrument. In the case of When Doves Cry, reportedly, there was a bass guitar and he simply muted it at the last moment. And then the song became what we know.
Ah.
I mean, Kiss is just him and a bouncing drum pattern and this kind of treated acoustic guitar. And that's it. And again, like, that's really elegant and exciting to me. I know what you mean about the boring blues jam. I'm terrible when people talk to me about, like, let's jam, man. Like, I'm just not good at that.
Well, I can't picture you with your guitar style necessarily having a lot to.
No, you would be correct about that. Nobody needs to hear me try to do that.
There's not a lot of guitar solos on the record at all.
No.
And there's some kind of tricky riffs here and there.
Here's the weird truth about Beauty Pill and the thing that my band has to endure. As I said, like, I really wanted to become less of the singer, but I also wanted to become less of the guitarist. And then at some point, Devin or Drew said to me, like, so in the best case scenario, what would you be doing? And I'm like,
Man the MacBook and
signal. Yeah, just like kind of like be on stage, nodding my head. No, I mean, that's not actually true. But it's a record that is packed with a lot of information. I really think that Describes Things has a lot of detail and a lot to take in. I don't think anyone regards it as a minimal record.
Just looking at live footage from this last tour, it looks like Jean is the one that you put on. What is that thing that she's pushing buttons on that seems to be triggering things on the MacBook?
It's called a Monome, Monome. Anybody that's interested in can go to monome.org.
Ah.
They're a really cool company run by a husband and wife in upstate New York, and they design these really beautiful and philosophically backed. One of the most obvious things you would think about the Monome would be to color code it. Gene plays this box of lights and buttons, and all the lights are the same color. And from a practical point of view, if you're making something, an instrument that someone is going to play, you would think that you would at least explore different ways of helping the user find where the buttons are supposed to be. And they chose not to do that. So the people who make it have very strong beliefs. They're both, I think, PhD level art students. Jean is sort of part of their community now.
So she's triggering sequence things. Why do that as opposed to just have the whole backing track simply play without the need for someone pushing a button? does it humanize it somehow? Like the
absolutely, yeah.
So it's like the equivalent of the horn part when you're doing ba-da, then she's pushing that, and the imperfections allow it to.
She essentially uses the monom like an NPC. You know, she's triggering samples. She's playing a keyboard essentially. It's just laid out a little differently. In her case, she's using it to control Ableton Live software, which is synchronized with Devin also has an Ableton Live rig at his drum kit. I mean, what she's doing is looks more mysterious than it is. She's essentially just triggering sounds in an unusual way.
Well, let's get the third song on the table for consideration. We're going back in time to 2001 to your first Beauty Pill EP, The Cigarette Girl from the Future. The song was The Idiot Heart. And speaking of not having guitar solos, well, this thing starts off with, it's not an improvised guitar solo, but it is a guitar. It is playing the melody. It's in the forefront. Therefore, it is a solo.
Yes.
And has a lot more of sort of the traditional rock band setup, even though it still has the little atmospheric synths and things and other, well, you can just hear the beginning. You have a, I assume this is an actual harp, not a sampled harp.
I'm trying to remember. It's a long time ago. I think that we did record the harp.
Do you have anything about the theme of the song or what it's trying to do before they hear it?
The sound of this song was supposed to sound a little bit like an homage to Phil Spector. It's really over the top. It opens with its absolutely silly timpani roll and, you know, this glissando harp cascading Angels with Wings and MGM movie opening. There's an aspect of parody or satire.
And tell me, since you're using electronic drums some of the time, is he able to pull out the timpani sound for this or for similar things?
Yeah, you know, okay. When we have done this live, Devin plays the toms and mallets and everything.
All right, well, let's play it.
Thank you.
So it's similarities in the structure. I mean, again, we have a part toward the end where the devil won't greenlight your project that repeats a little bit, but it's actually fairly self-contained compared. It's actually even after that, where you've got a minute and a half left in the song, where you've got a couple instrumental sections. You've got a guitar riff, and then you've got a different guitar riff that kind of sounds like a koto, and you get strings that eventually come in. I think there's still the timpani at the end. The actual harp does not come back, I guess, because you pass it off. You pass that song off to a guitar that seems like it's engineered to resemble the harp pretty damn closely. That is the thing that punctuates the first couple verses. And
that's very true. That's a very good observation.
What else about this song? You've got the really nice layering. You've got the, so this is a Joanne Gall doing the vocals, which again, yes. So by the end, you can hear, okay, this is why you had a female singer do this. But the first verse sounds like that's in your range. Like,
it does.
Why aren't you just passing this off? Or that?
Our voices are very similar. I thought Joanne had a really, you know, we've never invited a singer to join the band. Joanne was completely untrained, had no experience in singing. She's really funny, and she's a cool person, and she has a kind of a sexy speaking voice. And I thought, you know, I wonder what would happen if she tried to sing. And that's how we got her into Beauty Pill. I just, you know, in general, in looking for bandmates, I go on personal energy more than particular acumen with any particular instrument. Huh. The reason why Abram Goodrich, who, as you noted, was the bass player in Smart and Crazy and was the drummer in the first incarnation of Beauty Pill.
On this song that we just heard, yep.
He's just got a really cool way about him. He's just a very handsome, elegant, dignified dude who makes everything seem more, I'm going to use the word classy, but I don't really like that word. I don't know. He's has a great aesthetic vibe, I guess. And in Joanne's case, we didn't really gravitate to working with her because she was a musician. We just liked her. We just thought she was really great and wanted to hang out with her. And playing in a band with her was a great excuse for doing that. Her voice is low enough that I can sing The Idiot Heart, but it sounds cooler with her voice, in my opinion.
Sure. Let's talk about a little bit what the song is about.
There's lots of levels of communication going on in this song. One of them was the particular circumstance of Beauty Pill being in the late 90s, early 2000s DC punk scene, which absolutely celebrated rawness and unadornedness. So the absolutely like kind of absurd level of florid detail and sonic glamour that's in this song was intended to be kind of a provocative rebellion from that milieu that we were in. The song is about art and commerce. Sometimes people look at the title and they presume that it's a romantic song, but it was really about the urge when art and commerce collide for art to dumb itself down. You know, if you're going to sign to a big label, that's when you start having to like remove the edgy details from your music or the whatever, the eccentricities that aren't going to be easy to sell to a mainstream audience. Or if you're making a movie, that's why the line, the devil won't greenlight your project. You're going to have to face this big corporation and simplify your ideas in order for them to get funding. And so the song is referring to that dynamic.
And isn't it wonderful that we... You can just make things now. I don't know. It seems like...
It's interesting. Yeah. At the time, I had produced a band called The Dismemberment Plan, who had gone into the belly of the beast and signed with Interscope Records. This is like, you know, a lifetime ago. And I remember the meetings at Interscope were, for me, just terrifying. And just feeling like, oh, this is just not going to go well. And I was right. It did not go well. So Idiot Heart is somewhat inspired by that. I had also gone to see, with my girlfriend at the time, I had gone to see an Iranian movie called Children of Heaven. And the showing that I saw of this movie, the director spoke before the screening and explained that in Iran, if you're trying to make a political movie, you have to use children because you can't use adults in any kind of politically charged movie because you will be censored and the government won't allow it to happen. So oftentimes filmmakers in Iran express political themes through the use of children and children's situation, children actors. And I thought that was interesting, you know, imagining working within a government, working in a culture where you not only not get funding, but might be arrested or something horrible happened to someone in your family because of the content of your art. That was interesting to me too, that I wanted to write about. So the song is a kind of elliptical reference to all of those ideas of artists facing the man, I guess.
And yet it's such just a kind of a triumphant, almost cheesy, as you said, at the, you know, especially at the beginning, but in a way that is why I like rock music. Some big, loud, basic stuff and a hummable melody here. I don't know. Is this a style that you feel like you've gotten away from generally? If we move a little bit to start to introduce the last song that we're not going to talk about, The Prize, which is an Ardo Lindsay cover, just looking at his catalog, he's a subtle guy. Kind of the exact opposite of this song here.
Yeah, this song is bombastic and insane and Dayglow and absolutely dripping with cherry candy or whatever. To me, it was a genre take. I didn't think of it as a particular style that we would necessarily revisit. A lot of the songs on that EP are kind of like their own genre. I don't know if I would ever do something like that again, although later on, many, you know, like a decade plus later on our new record, the grandeur and the level of adornment, I guess, that we use on Idiot Heart is no longer, you know, sarcastic. It's something we do all the time. So, you know, it's like you be careful what you
pretend to be.
Yeah, exactly. I like that song. It's fun to play.
I agree. Very fun to listen to. And I think takes sort of fewer listens than, I don't know, I got to say with the new record sinking into it, now I feel I get it. But at first I was a little overwhelmed by just the amount of sequencing, and it was just an approach that you've hit on something unique, or I haven't listened to enough Tribe Called Quest, but it took me a little effort to get into in a way that the Idiot Heart just doesn't. That keep this in the set, put it as your encore or something. Keep it.
I hear you. This record was met with a lot of very positive response.
Yeah.
I saw it as a kind of a more challenging thing. And that's something that people might reject. I've been really surprised by how quickly it was embraced. Because I thought of it as like, well, you know, a lot of people are, I mean, 7-minute songs with like dissonant horns.
Yeah, but just the sonic quality by itself is, I think, feels, if people say it's cinematic, it's because it sounds as slick and professional as things that are in movies now. Let's just say that. Whereas the average DC punk band, that's not what they're going for.
Professional is never really like on my mind necessarily, but I'm happy if people hear it that way. I would certainly love to score some movies. So if people want to ask me to score movies, I'd probably say yes.
Just take some of those layers of drums out. We got to put it in the background of people walking around.
People keep saying like, it's your music is so cinematic. And I'm like, why hasn't anyone called me for Blade Runner 2?
Yeah, to me, it seems a little more in your face than cinematic would connote, that there's a little too much going on.
I agree with that.
Quite boring enough for the movies, unless it's a montage. Then you can have a nice Africana barista instrumental part montage with the swirling colors. I don't know what's going on in the movie during that, but there you go. Well, say more about, before we say goodbye here, about this cover we're about to hear from why this Ardo Lindsay song? This is like the last thing you added to the album, correct?
That is correct. I think Ardo Lindsay is a genius. And you're right in that he traffics entirely in subtlety. And to me, the world does not reward subtlety from musicians. It's the one trait that you're pretty much actively discouraged. And it's bold to make an entire body of work that it traffics entirely in subtlety. He is a big influence on me and someone who I admire tremendously. His music has a wide range. Some of it is really sour and dissonant and difficult to listen to and kind of distorted and fucked up. And a lot of his music is the opposite of that. It's very sexy, seductive, feminine, and enveloping, gentle and warm. The prize, the actual song, The Prize, is somewhere in between those two things. But I love his music, and I feel like we pulled off a pretty good version of it. But I'm mainly happy that it has increased, seems to have increased people's interest and curiosity about his work. I think he's 62 years old now.
Yep.
He's revered in certain circles, but he's not as famous as I feel that he should be. And I hope that people, if like the kids that like Beauty Pill are discovering Arta Lindsay, that's super cool to me. I like the song as a song, but I'm happy about drawing that connection.
All right. Well, let's play it for him. Hear your style meshed into this kind of Latin, I was going to say low key, but I don't mean low pitch wise. I just mean it's laid back thing, but with your giant drum over it. I got a kick out of that. Anyway.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for doing this. It's been a real pleasure talking to you.
Thank you so much for asking me. I really appreciate it. I'm happy to always happy to talk about content.
When did I empty my empty mind? Did you see me let go of myself? Before I lose sight of that picture of you, better place it face down on the bed. Notice how nature replaces what was mine, but still leaves me to drown in my style. Reinvent me, remind me how we stuck to our past. Go ahead, fasten me down. Rub words away. Violent and hectic and wise. Peace in disguise. Dust covers the prize. Violent and hectic and bite marks and scratches. Elbows and knees in our dollhouse. The furniture's capsized. Rushing, stalling in our disbelief. Folded back into our own surprise. Rub words away. Roll back in the shade. Violent and hectic and wise. Peace in disguise. Dust covers the prize. Violent and hectic and rub words away. Roll back in the shade. Violent and hectic and wise. Skies. Dust covers the prize.
All right. Thanks to Chad Clark. Again, you can read about their music at beautypill.com. And if you look at nakedlyexaminedmusic.com for the blog post corresponding to this episode, I will link to another interview with Chad, that Chunky Glasses interview where he talks about his illness and what he was doing between the first bunch of Beauty Pill creations, which were an album and a couple of EPs, and then this jump to 2015, which we mostly talked about today. A link to his appearance on NPR. Talking to Chad did get me to go listen to Tribe Called Quest. And though I already had this in mind, we are going to have some rap covered on this podcast before too long. Beauty Pill is a good transition band for me. You know, a rock guy, like his Smart When Crazy stuff. Getting into electronic music, it's often easy for people like me to be a little dismissive. You know, where's the musicianship? But I think Chad does it the way it should be done. And whether it was listening to this or otherwise trying to lean in this direction anyway, I've been listening to a lot of Daft Punk in recent weeks, a band that I'm sure I will never get on the podcast. And we're definitely have some more electronica people coming up. Hey, just to remind you, if you want to hear some of my music, go check out marklint.com or search for Mark Lint or New People, my previous band, on iTunes or Spotify. Thanks, as always, to everyone who listened. Hope you found Chad as interesting as I did. If you like the podcast, please go to the iTunes store and give it us a nice rating, little review, and use your social media outlets to share this episode, any other episodes you found interesting. Again, the URL you should be sending people is nakedlyexaminedmusic.com. Until next time, this is Mark Lintonmeyer signing off.